Last week, we looked at Peter's testimony of the prophetic word. We talked about fables and fairy tales and Greek and Roman mythology. At the end of 2 Peter chapter 1, Peter wants the Christian audience to understand that he's talking about an eyewitness testimony. It's not just legends and fairy tales, but he and the other apostles were eyewitness to Jesus' majesty. And he relates the story of what we call the Transfiguration. And we turn back to Matthew and read part of that story. This morning, in contrast to a witness and a testimony that is true, Peter is going to warn about false prophets and false teachers. We're going to look at 2 Peter chapter 2 and read the first 11 verses this morning. But there were also false prophets among the people, even as there will be false teachers among you who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, even denying the Lord who bought them, and bring on themselves swift destruction. And many will follow their destructive ways, because of whom the way of truth will be blasphemed. By covetousness they will exploit you with deceptive words. For a long time their judgment has not been idle, and their destruction does not slumber. For if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of eight people, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood on the world of the ungodly, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them to destruction, making them an example to those who afterward would live ungodly, and delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked, for that righteous man dwelling among them tormented his righteous soul from day to day by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds. Then the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptations and to reserve the unjust under punishment for the day of judgment, especially those who walk according to the flesh in the lust of uncleanness and despise authority. They are presumptuous, self-willed. They are not afraid to speak evil of dignitaries, whereas angels who are greater in power and might do not bring a reviling accusation against them before the Lord. There were some really long sentences in Peter's argument because he's setting up almost like a geometry proof, if you remember doing those. He makes several if-then statements in order to come to a point, but we will dissect these statements. We'll try to bite off portions small enough that we can chew and digest this morning. Go back to the beginning of the chapter. Peter is going to use some Old Testament characters to teach some New Testament church lessons. And he starts, like I say, it's in contrast to last week's lesson. Last week he's talking about a true testimony. He's talking about eyewitnesses to Jesus' majesty. And he wants the audience to know that they can believe his words because they have several eyewitness accounts. He begins by saying, you know, there have been false prophets before. There were false prophets in the old times. And even now and in the future, there'll be false teachers. So don't be surprised. But he's also saying, don't worry about that too much. The false teachers have sealed their own doom. Don't worry about false teachers. We need to do what we can to make sure people understand the truth. But the wicked will not go unpunished. And those that are godly, those that seek God, will not be forgotten. It's an encouragement for us to keep doing good, even though there's plenty of people doing evil in the world. Your first fill in the blank. There were false prophets, past tense, talking about the Old Testament. And there will be false teachers beginning with first century Christianity and going forward. There were false prophets in the past, and now and in the future there will be false teachers. Think back to King Ahab and his wife Jezebel. See, prophets and sometimes Bible teachers are kind of like political advisors. You can surround yourself with yes men. The president could fill his cabinet with people that just agree with everything he says. Now, our current president perhaps has trouble finding people agree with everything he says. There have been more people appointed and nominated and fired, perhaps, than any other administration. I don't want to say too much. It would be an honor, perhaps, to serve on the president's cabinet or as an advisor. I hope Trump doesn't call me and make an offer. That would take some serious consideration, because I don't think that appointment would last very long. All of his positions seem to be temporary. He needs a temp placement service. But if you surround yourself with yes men, you never get any different opinions. You might as well not have advisors if all you want is a room full of people that agree with you. Ahab and Jezebel had their own prophets that no matter what Ahab wanted to do, they would just nod and tell him that was God's will, and God would profit that. They would say religious sounding things and tell Ahab and Jezebel whatever they wanted to hear, and it sounded like they were prophesying when they did it. Micaiah was not an Ahab or Jezebel yes man. And so Jehoshaphat, and it's in 1 Kings chapter 22. I'm not going to turn there. You could look it up later. You should never take my word for it, but we're not going to take that time this morning. 1 Kings 22. Jehoshaphat says to King Ahab, "Is there no other prophet that we can hear from?" And he's like, "Well, there's this one guy, but he never has anything good to say about me." So they went and they got Micaiah, and he came and he prophesied the true will of God. He told them what God instructed him to say, and he didn't add anything to it, and he didn't leave anything out. And Ahab was like, "See, what'd I tell you? This guy never has anything good to say about me." Because to Ahab, that was the most important thing the prophets could do, was tell him he was in God's will and God was going to prosper everything he went out and did, whether that was the truth or not. Sometimes the truth is not a commodity that is highly valued or prized. There have always been false prophets before, and Ahab had a gang of them. And the actual prophets, Jesus makes the statement about the Jewish leaders in his time and says, "Your fathers, your forefathers, all day long they killed the prophets." That's pretty condemning. He's like, your ancestors, the previous generations that you descend from, that's all they did was kill the prophets. Your fathers killed the prophets, just like you're not listening to me today. And you can see that Micaiah was ignored. We see Jeremiah being thrown into a cistern, but it was dry. There was no water. He sunk in the mud, and later some people came and pulled him out with ropes. Old Testament prophet was not necessarily a glorious position that people aspired to, because sometimes when you bring the true word of God, that is many times not what people want to hear. Sometimes even we don't want to hear the truth that comes from God, but we realize hopefully that it is good for us. It's in our best interest. I don't want to eat broccoli. I don't like Brussels sprouts. Sometimes we go ahead and do things we need to do, whether it's what we necessarily want to do or not, but You know, David in Psalms 1, he says, the law of the Lord, that is my joy. My delight is in the law of the Lord. I meditate on that day and night. Sometimes we get into the right place where we desire to hear everything that God has to say. There were false prophets. There's going to be false teachers. Don't worry, Peter's saying. Their fate is already sealed, and they're going to get the judgment they deserve. What he does, beginning in verse 4, is sets up a set of proof statements. He says, God did not spare the angels, but he cast them down to hell and be delivered in the chains of darkness to be reserved for their own judgment. He's talking about when Lucifer and a third of the angels fell from heaven. But it's if. If God did not do that, then we know this to be true. So he makes several if statements. God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down. In verse 5, he did not spare the ancient world. But he saved Noah, one of eight people who was a herald of righteousness when he brought the flood to the ungodly. So God knows how to punish the wicked and spare the just. And he sets up several cases. He gives two examples of each. He gives two examples of judgment, and he gives two examples of salvation. The world was destroyed in the ancient times, but Noah and his family were saved. The cities of Sodom and Gomorrah were turned into ashes. He condemned them to destruction. But in verse 7, he delivered Lot, who was oppressed by filthy conduct of the wicked. And look at the parenthetical insert. My Bible has verse number 8 set off in parentheses because he's going to stop in the middle of his argument and kind of explain what he means. Peter says Lot was a righteous man and that his soul was tormented because he lived in a wicked city. Lot and his family were taken out of Sodom and Gomorrah before judgment rained down and destroyed those cities. We know something about Lot. We know a few things about Lot. That was Abraham's nephew. And as their flocks and herds were increasing, there was a point where the land could no longer sustain them. And Abraham says, look, we need to separate from each other. If you go left, I'll go right. If you go this way, I'll go that way, but we have to separate our flocks and take our servants in different directions and our families because this one spot can't support all the people and livestock we have. And Lot looked around and he saw that this particular land was good and it was well watered and he said, I will go there. Abraham gave him a choice. Lot picked the best of the two choices. If given a choice, any of us might have done the same thing. But he gets down in the valley of Sodom and Gomorrah, and those cities were wicked. And if you carefully read the text, we find Lot was sitting in the city gates. And you got to know a little bit about their history to understand what that meant. Each city functioned as its own autonomous government. If you've ever heard the statement, city-states. There weren't federal inspectors and state-level authorities that came and did this. You didn't apply for licenses from the state. There wasn't different levels of government and oversight. The city of Sodom, the city of Gomorrah, they had city leaders. And they made decisions and passed legislation, and they heard individual legal cases. Lot was sitting at the city gates with the elders of that city. He didn't just move into the valley and was close to them. He participated in the local city government. Think about joining the city council here in Plainville or going to city hall, being a council member, meeting with the mayor at the council meetings once a month. That's kind of what Lot was. He wasn't just close by. He didn't just move into the area. they accepted him into their society and he participated in the government. And if the city was corrupt and everyone there was evil, he was participating in the evil that was going on. The Bible does not say here that Lot was evil. Peter twice calls him a righteous man. He says, righteous Lot, in one verse that I can't see right now, and says this righteous man in verse 8. He calls him righteous Lot in verse 7. He calls him a righteous man in verse 8. Perhaps sometimes he made bad decisions. But when God brought judgment to Sodom and Gomorrah, Lot and his family were taken out before destruction fell. So in your, I think we skipped some of the blanks there. Your last fill in the blank, number 3, should say Lot was a righteous man that did not always make the best decisions. Lot was a righteous man that did not always make the best decisions. And that's good news for us, by the way. We'll come back to that thought in just a moment. The second fill in the blank, I said it and I just didn't point it out that we should write the words down. God knows how to deliver the godly and punish the unjust. God knows how to deliver the godly and punish the unjust. There's a parable that Jesus shares about a man whose servants went out and they sowed good seed in the field. And his enemy came and sowed tares. Think of that as weeds, briars. I don't know how it happens. If you come over to my house, we could walk through the yard, we could look in the woods, we could look in the neighbor's yards. There are no morning glories over there anywhere. But if we went out in the spring and plowed up the ground, morning glories would just magically appear and would start growing. Something about a garden attracts them. I think they travel for miles around to come up with your tomato plants and your okra and your green beans. Morning glories and ragweed. Ragweed is terrible on people's seasonal allergies, and the roots go down about 8 feet, and they're embedded into the ground. When you're planting your garden and stuff starts coming up and you get ready to weed, sometimes it's hard to tell early what the plants are you want to keep and what the weeds are, and the easy way to tell is just to give them a little gentle tug. If you pull on it and it very easily comes up out of the ground, that was a plant you wanted to keep. And if you pull on it gently and then pull a little harder and it doesn't come up, that's a weed. Jesus says this man went out into his field and sowed good seed, but his enemy came and sowed tares, weeds, briars. And when everything started growing up, the servants said to the landowner, they said to their master, look what has happened. We know we sowed good seed. Should we go out into the field and pull up the tares? And their master said, you can't do that. If you try to pull up the tares, you'll pull up the crop with it. Everything will come up out of the ground. Let it grow. And at harvest time, we'll go through the field and we'll separate the wheat from the tares, and we'll take the weeds and the briars and we'll bundle up and we'll burn them and then we'll collect the harvest. And Jesus used that analogy so that we could understand the judgment. And it's exactly what Peter is saying here. The world is filled with the righteous and the unrighteous. In Jesus' parable, the godly and the ungodly live side by side, but God knows how to tell them apart. God knows if you're ragweed or not. He knows the difference between tomato plants and morning glories. And it doesn't matter that we're all growing in the same field when it's time for harvest on the day of judgment. God is perfectly capable of saying to one, depart from me, you worker of iniquity, I never knew you. And to the other, enter into the joy of your Lord. Well done, my good and faithful servant. Peter gives several examples of the world being destroyed in the ancient time and Noah and his family being saved. He gives the example of Sodom and Gomorrah when fire and brimstone rained down from heaven, but Lot and his wife and his children were saved. His wife didn't make it because she didn't fully follow the instructions she was given, but she got out of Sodom and Gomorrah. God knew how to save her. She was not fully obedient. There's a whole sermon we could preach on partial obedience. Partial obedience, following half the instructions, is still disobedience because we didn't follow all of the instructions. But that's another sermon for another day. Verse 9, the Lord knows how to deliver the godly, and he knows how to reserve judgment and punishment for those that deserve it on the day of judgment. We can learn from Noah and from Lot. There's another lesson there. Noah was a righteous man. Peter here calls him a preacher of righteousness. If we go back to Genesis and look at the text, the world displeased God. The Bible says God looked at the world, he saw the sin in the world, he saw people marrying and being given in marriage, there was drunkenness, there was idolatry, there's all the things wrong in the world, and the Bible actually says that God regretted the man he had created and put on the earth, and he resolved to cleanse his creation. He wasn't going to destroy the creation, he was going to wipe humanity off the face of it. But when he looked at Noah, Noah pleased the Lord. Lot did not live separated from the world. Lot was not walking circumspectly of the nations. Lot was right down there in the valley of Sodom and Gomorrah. And he's not just in the valley, he's sitting in the city gates. He is passing judgment and making laws with the city leaders. But God saved them both. God saved Noah from the destruction of the flood. God saved Lot from the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. The individuals had different character. They made different life choices. But Lot was a righteous man in a bad situation, and in both cases God saved them. God, in 2 Peter chapter 2, he saved Noah in verse 5, he saved Lot in verse 7. Some of us are kind of like Noah. You know, there's that prodigal son parable Jesus tells. I think Luke chapter 15 is the only place you'll find it in the Gospels. The prodigal son goes out with half of the father's inheritance, spends everything that he has. He's feeding pigs. He goes back to his father and says, I'm willing to be a servant. The people working in your field as servants were better off than I was there for a while. And I'm willing to work for you and be a servant. And the father accepts him back into his house. He puts the robe on him and a ring on his finger and the shoes on his feet. And that's an example of how God welcomes us back into the family of God. But the older brother out in the field would not even come into the party. And the father goes out to check on him and he says, I've been here with you this whole time. This other son of yours, you notice it doesn't call him, he doesn't say my brother. He's like, this other son went out and wasted what was yours. And I've been here working for you this whole time. Some of us identify with a prodigal son. Some of us identify with a brother. Some of us might say, well, I've been coming to this church for X number of years. I've been bringing my family to church. I brought my kids and my grandkids. I've paid my tithes. I've taught Sunday school. I made Kool-Aid at Vacation Bible School. I've been here this whole time. And the point of the older brother in the prodigal son story is so that we recognize God is aware of those things. If you've spent a lifetime in church, God knows and God will reward a life of service and devotion. But for the one that leaves and goes into the world, there is rejoicing in heaven when that one is saved, and comes home. The one went out in the world and wasted everything and wallowed in the muck and the mire and wanted to eat the pig slop. The other brother was a faithful servant that worked hard for his dad. God saves them both. Some of us identify with the prodigal. Some of us identify with the older brother. Perhaps some of us identify with Cain, and some of us identify with Abel, the sons of Adam and Eve, when one brought a sacrifice that was pleasing to God and the other brought a sacrifice that God did not honor. He wasn't punished. He had the opportunity to go out and do better, but he got his feelings hurt and he ended up committing murder. Some of us identify with Cain and some with Abel, some with the prodigal and some with the brother. In this story in 2 Peter chapter 2, perhaps some of us identify with Noah, perhaps some of us identify with Lot. Notice that God saves them both. And that should be an encouragement to us. God knows how to save the righteous, even though we live in the world with the wicked and the ungodly. And when the time comes, he knows how to separate the two and punish the wicked. There have been false prophets in the past. There's going to be false teachers in the future. Don't worry about that. This is a message of encouragement that reminds us and explains God will sort it all out when the time comes for sorting. Keep doing good. Keep working. Keep sharing the gospel. Keep teaching the right things, knowing that God is paying attention and understands and will reward faithfulness. Let's pray together.